From NPR News, I'm Tony Cox. On today's show, Colorado Senator Ben Nighthorse Campbell, the Senate's sole Native American member, joins us to talk politics and to look forward to his retirement next month. Also, veteran financial journalist Lynette Calfani, author of Zero Debt, The Ultimate Guide to Financial Freedom, shares some tips on how you can spend smart this holiday season. And finally, correspondent Allison Keyes takes a closer look at benefit concerts. They're popular now and wildly successful. But who really benefits? But first, communities on the edge. Although authorities have not yet determined a motive for the recent torching of a Charles County, Maryland subdivision, the Associated Press reported that two of the six suspects currently in custody used racial epithets during the interrogation, raising the question whether this was a racially motivated attack. What happens when one ethnic group, more affluent and better educated perhaps, moves into the enclave of another group? It puts the community on edge often. And to talk more about this edge community phenomenon, we will be joined a little later by architect and urban planner M. David Lee and Andy Tarsi of the Anti-Defamation League. But first, here to talk specifics about the Maryland case is Rona Cobell, a reporter for the Baltimore Sun. Rona, nice to have you on.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Let's start with this. Give us a clear picture, if you can, of the Charles County community and of the suspects who are involved in this.
Historically, Charles County has been a predominantly white county, but the county is the second fastest growing in the state, and it's becoming increasingly diverse. As your listeners are probably aware, most of the residents moving into the subdivision are African American. Many are coming from neighboring Prince George's County. What we know about the suspects are that all six of them are white in their early 20s, working low-wage jobs in the area. We know that four of them did not graduate from high school, and that three of the six are distant cousins. Their main recreational activity seems to be hanging out at the local Wendy's and the Denny's on the main highway and racing cars.
Now, was this attack, as far as the authorities have been able to determine so far, racially motivated or not?
We don't actually know. The prosecutors are keeping their options open. I think it's important to remember that we have six suspects so far, and there may actually not be one motive. We know that of the six, one was angry at the security company that he worked at, and another one couldn't get a job at the subdivision and may have been angry about that. A third possibly wanted to get notoriety for his group. So it's very possible that what we have here is a group of people who acted in concert but were motivated by different factors.
Do we know that all of the families that were involved, either those who had already purchased homes or those who were intending to buy the homes that were not completely constructed yet, were they all African-American families?
I don't believe they were all African-American families. I believe they were of different races, but I think the significant piece of that is not so much the race of the people moving in, but the fact that this is a very rural area, and what you have here is this sort of constant encroachment of suburbia on these rural areas, which makes people very upset and makes them lament the old way of life. A lot of these people who live in Charles County and other rural areas of Maryland have been there for generations, and they're watching the farmland disappear and the subdivisions go up. So I think that there is a bit of resentment there, and not necessarily because of the race of the people.
Rona Cobell is a reporter for the Baltimore Sun. Rona, thank you very much.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
And now, here to give us a more detailed understanding of the edge community phenomenon are Andy Tarsi, East Coast Legal Counsel for the Anti-Defamation League, and David Lee, an architect and urban planner with the Boston firm Stull & Lee and a professor at the Harvard School of Design. Gentlemen, welcome.
Thank you.
David, thank you for having me.
David, let's start with you. As an urban planner, you understand both the structural and social fabric of a community. Can you give us a better sense of just what an edge community looks like?
Yeah, an edge community is a relatively new phenomenon, I'd say maybe over the last 15 years or so. And these are communities further out than your sort of traditional first ring of suburbs, your older suburbs. These are communities that have sprung up where interstate highway off-ramps and things have occurred in the Cloverleafs and so forth, which then have spawned the shopping centers and the malls and things, which frankly have become new town centers for many communities. And so as a result now, you're starting to see farmland disappear and subdivisions come up in these areas. And they've been sort of, as well as office parks and so forth, and collectively they've been called edge cities.
Andy, the FBI recently released its annual hate crimes report. How do the edge communities factor into that equation, if at all?
Well, it's such a new term that they're not looking at that consciously. It would be interesting to go into the data, though, given this insight, and see if these communities are places where that kind of activity is happening. Often, hate arises in a complicated context where there are intergroup tensions based on a number of different things, people who don't understand or know their neighbors, and things like arguing over a parking space can turn into a racial encounter. It would be disingenuous to say that it started out as a racial encounter, but when you're angry and the person represents that encroachment or threat that the other guests have been talking about, it can become very much a place where that hate boils to the surface and becomes a point of violence.
Let's pursue that a little bit more, David. What about that? Because can this be attributed primarily to race, or is it a matter of class, or is it a matter of perhaps a combination of the both, where these tensions rise in these what we'll call suburb of the suburb communities?
Yeah, I think it's a combination of both factors. I don't think you can dismiss the race or ethnicity component of these kinds of things. It's almost impossible to separate those two issues. But the idea of class distinctions, and those sometimes boiling over into violence, is age old. And you will find often that you'll have a community that's sort of the upscale community, and then you'll have an adjacent community where most of the people who service that upscale community, whether they're yard people or they are, essentially drive trucks and do the other kinds of things that are necessary in an overall community, live, and then there are tensions usually between the two high schools in the different cities and so forth, and it's sort of the stuff of a lot of novels and things like that.
Andy, is there a geographic pattern to where these communities are popping up around the country that we can that can provide any answers or shed any light on what is happening and where and why?
I don't know enough about that trend yet. It's something that we're starting to have people ask about more and more. But what we do know is that wherever there are changes in society, there are intergroup tensions. And, you know, change can be very volatile. And if not handled and managed and carefully and thoughtfully in any context, it can produce negative results. So that doesn't just apply to this situation. That's everything in our lives. So, one thing that worries me is that hate comes out of ignorance. It comes out of fear. It comes out of people being threatened. I have no idea if this is really what's involved in the Maryland case, but we see it in situations where there's not a sense of community, a sense of mutual investment, understanding, bridges between different cultures. And so if these communities are sort of lacking in that kind of soul and that kind of connection because they are sort of out there on the off the highway, you know, mall driven, and the history of working through issues as a town and knowing each other and having pulpit exchanges among the houses of worship and, you know, the usual fun stuff that makes a town stick together, then it's a recipe for concern, because the lashing out at the other is very, very easy when you don't know them.
This is an old story in one sense, David, in terms of the African-American experience, at least, people trying to escape the urban core and get out to areas that are safer, where the air is fresher, where life is quote-unquote better. But my question to you is this, and we'll bring our conversation to a close on this. There is an evolutionary process, it seems to me, that when you move into new areas, whether you are accepted or at least left alone, takes a certain amount of time. How much time does it take? Should it take?
You know, I think this may be a generational thing because it's really quite interesting. This is almost counter to the more current trends in terms of urbanization, in that you have the empty nesters and sometimes wealthier people who are now rediscovering the joys of the city and are moving back in the cities, getting rid of the cars, I mean the big houses, the extra car, and the long commute. And they are, in fact, repopulating a lot of our urban cores and, frankly, pumping a lot of energy into those places. On the other hand, for the this generation of African Americans who are beginning to have some affluence and some accomplishment, they're looking in the other direction. They're looking for the big house and the big lot out in the country somewhere. So you have sort of countervailing forces there. And I think it's going to take a while. I think Andy makes an excellent point. There are no civic places that bring people together to sort things out as a community. With a combination of internet, cell phones, and automobile connections, you know, there's really no reason for these people to come together and try and slog through some of these differences.
Well, Andy, let me ask you to follow up briefly. Is there something to the notion that people just don't want to be around other black people, or is it primarily they don't want to be around Jewish people, or who is it that nobody seems to want to live next to?
Boy, if I knew the answer to that, I'll tell you. Racism is a real reality in this country. Its history is a lot deeper and more complicated than people realize, and anti-Semitism as well, and many other kinds of issues about xenophobia and homophobia. Now we're dealing with trying to get people to understand that they need to reach out and make connections with the Muslim communities and understand each other. I think that's here to stay. You know, it's like how many of us water our lawn on July 1st and then kick back for the rest of the summer and expect it to stay green. It's just not a reality. You know, you don't feed a baby in the morning and then when she's crying in the afternoon, wonder why. So the question is, can these edge communities embrace a paradigm of building community that's as hard as keeping your grass green all summer?
That's where we're going to have to stop it, though, Andy. Time's run out on us, unfortunately. I appreciate your input, though. Andy Tarsi is the East Coast Legal Counsel for the Anti-Defamation League. David Lee, an architect and urban planner, and a professor at the Harvard Design School. Gentlemen, thank you both for being with us.
Thank you
for having us.